You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
My name is Mwangi Kemenyi. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings and the director of the Africa Growth Initiative. And I would like to welcome you to this event. And before I begin, this event is being webcasted. And the hashtag for those of you following us on webcasts is hashtag Foresight Africa and hashtag Kenya Decides. Foresight Africa and Kenya Decides. On behalf of my colleagues at the Africa Growth Initiative and Brookings Institution, I'm very happy to welcome you to this event on the Kenyan elections, now less than 2 weeks away. And I'm particularly grateful to my colleagues here, the panelists, who are my good friends who have accepted to participate in this event. And as I was looking through, although my colleague will introduce them, this is a very unique panel. They have one thing in common that many of you may not know, but each one of them have passed through the University of Nairobi, including the lady next to me, at one point or other. this election is critically important for the Kenyans, and will shape the country's development trajectory. It is particularly important because this is the first election after the post-election violence of 2007, and also it's one being held under a new constitution. This gives Kenya a great opportunity to reclaim its position as a beacon of peace and stability. It is a time for redemption, so to say. But it also has implications that go beyond the country's borders, especially in East Africa and indeed in entire East and Central Africa. In fact, we can say that it has even much wider implications for the wider international community. I'm therefore very excited that the Africa Growth Initiative has organized this event, and we are able to host it, and we have a great panelist, and we are looking forward for a lively conversation. And it is therefore my great pleasure to hand over to my good friend, Vincent Macquarie, who is a host of Africa in Focus, the Voice of America. He is a seasoned and versatile journalist with years of experience in journalism, working in Africa, Europe, and U.S. During his career, he has covered a wide range of stories, including the Africa Union Summit in Lusaka, Zambia, the UN General Assembly, International Trade and Technology Fair in Berlin and Hanover, Germany, the International AIDS Conference in Mexico City, and the G20 Summit in Pittsburgh. He has interviewed high-ranking officials and presidents, among them former U.S. President George W. Bush, President Bigu wa Mutharika of Malawi, former President of Ghana John Kufuor, President Pohaba of Namibia, the late Nobel laureate Wangari Maathai, African Development Bank President Donald Kaberuka, Professor Ali Maruzu, they are endless. So I'll hand it over to you, Vincent. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mwangi. That makes me sound like I'm really old, which is okay, too. Good afternoon once again. And I'm going to introduce the distinguished panelists here. That we have to my extreme right, in between Professor Kemenyi and Professor Kenyinga, is Jendai Fraser. Most people know her. She is known worldwide as a policy lead and expert on African affairs. She joined the faculty at Carnegie Mellon University in 2009 as a distinguished public service professor with joint appointments in the Department of Social and Decision Sciences and in the H. John Hines College School of Public Policy and Management. She's also director of Carnegie Mellon Center for International Policy and Innovation, that is CIPI, where she's particularly interested in utilizing technology and applying innovative solutions to core issues of development and governance in Africa. Ms. Fraser is was a special assistant to President and senior director for African Affairs at the National Security Council from January 2001 until her swearing in as the first woman U.S. ambassador to South Africa. That was 2009. And then she's widely credited for designing the Bush administration's policies for ending the war, wars in Democratic Republic of Congo, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Burundi. She was instrumental in resolving the crisis following 2007 presidential election in Kenya. So welcome to Ms. Jendai Fraser. Our other distinguished panelist is Professor Karuti Kanyingi, who is an accomplished development researcher and scholar with extensive national and international experience and exposure. He has carried out many research programs and projects at the Institute of Development Studies, University of Nairobi, for the past 20 years, where he is now an associate director. He has published extensively in development and also in Kenya, of course, and also is renowned for his contributions to scholarship and knowledge in governance and development. Very well known also particularly for his extensive research and publication on land rights in Kenya, which is a very critical issue there, civil society and development, ethnicity and development, and electoral policy, politics and development. Very much welcome to Professor Kanyinga. Welcome to our panelists. So I'm going to say a few words just about this discussion today. Professor Kimenya has already said quite a bit. We know the elections are coming just a few weeks, less than 2 weeks from now. This will be the first elections since 2007. Very unique elections because while the country has made a lot of progress since the last elections, which were visited by an eruption of violence, these elections are going to be conducted under a new constitution. And also, this is going to be the first time that we have presidential candidate and the running mate who are facing a case at the ICC, the International Criminal Court, for alleged role in the violence that followed the 2007 elections. So rather unique there. There's a lot of international pressure for free and fair elections in Kenya, and countrywide also people are calling for peace. So it's an election that everybody is closely watching. Well, without much ado, we're going to give our panelists just a few minutes to talk about our discussion today before we proceed with the questioning from the platform, and then we'll come to the audience. Later, you will have an opportunity to field questions to our panelists here. Now, I want to start with Professor Kanyinga. Give us 5 to 7 minutes of your sense of what we're talking about today.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to be here. But let me begin by saying that when you look at Kenya, and it has been repeatedly said before, that Kenyans generally looking at the same event or even processes tend to disagree about what they are seeing at any particular time. And yet they are looking at the same event, and therefore they end up having different discussions on what is actually happening. But if we were to look at this for the coming election and ask ourselves what are the factors shaping that election, we shall come to one particular conclusion that two factors or perhaps three factors are shaping this election and giving it the character it is taking now. One of them is the post-election violence of 2008. That post-election violence was the result of unconcluded presidential election results, and also the failure to date to prosecute anyone for the perpetration of that particular violence. With that particular violence, we have got two of four individuals who have been taken to the International Criminal Court because Kenya itself did not establish a tribunal to investigate and find out what happened with that post-election violence. As a result of that, we are moving to an election when nothing has been done on post-election violence. out of 5,000 cases that were known of perpetrators, both senior, middle, and lower perpetrators, only two or three people have been prosecuted. About 25 people have also been gone to court and their cases dismissed because of lack of evidence, implying here that the government does not seem to have capacity to investigate and bring culprits to account for their crimes. So when the ICC, as a result of the failure to prosecute anyone for the post-election violence, the ICC intervened, of course, in line with what had been agreed by the commission that was formed to investigate what was happening. The second factor that is influencing this election is the new constitution. That the post-election violence itself came out with a real framework, with a very lean framework of establishing coming up with a new constitution. Now, the new constitution is very unique in different ways. One, it has restructured how power is going to be used in Kenya. It has restructured the positions of political power and restructured governance in general. It has also come with new values and principles of governance that must guide public servants when they are conducting public business. Now, when put together, post-election violence cases and the new constitution means a lot for this particular election. A, we have new alliances that are forming. These alliances that are formed are not the traditional ethnic blocs that we have had in Kenya's history before. These alliances are unique. For the first time, we have got permanent enemies becoming partners in these alliances. For instance, Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto are some of the people suspected of post-election violence, and they are the people indicted by the International Criminal Court. During the 2008 period, they were both on different sides of the divide. They allegedly mobilized their different communities to fight each other. Now one of them is running as a president and the other one as his deputy. That's unique in its sense. On the other hand, we have got the prime minister and the vice president. They were both on different sides of the divide in 2008 during the post-election violence. And they have been fighting each other until very recently, until December, they were always fighting each other, and no one would have ever thought that they would ever be in any particular alliance. Now they are the best buddies together. One of them is the president, running as a president. The other one is running as a deputy. Now the question to ask then is, what is the motivation for these particular alliances? And to answer that question, we need to ask ourselves whether the state and its institutions in Kenya have ever been accountable. Once you get into that, you realize that these alliances are being formed as an end in itself rather than a means to an end. We may not be thinking about these alliances as alliances that are interested in furthering the interests of the new constitution, but A, to protect and defend the interests of a few individuals, that is the Jubilee Alliance, for instance, William Ruto and Uhuru Kenyatta forming the alliance simply to counter the ICC, and on the other hand, the other alliance also being formed for personal interest, for Prime Minister and the Vice President, forming it in order to improve their prospects of winning the election. Now, if we put it that way, then we can say that Kenya is actually at a very complex period in its time. Because even if any of the alliance were to win the election, it would have its own consequences. Any alliance has got its own consequences, especially in terms of promoting reforms and good order and democratic governance. Let me stop there.
Thank you very much, Professor Kanyinga, for keeping your 5 to 7 minute quarter. Now let's listen to Ambassador Fraser. Give us a few minutes of take on this topic.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here, and especially to be on a panel of fellow Kenyans. I feel very much at home. I did spend a lot of time as an undergraduate at the University of Nairobi, and then on to graduate school and even teaching there. So Kenya is a country that is very close to my heart, place I first went in Africa and was just there last week and have been there at least twice. And I'm extremely excited, frankly, about these elections and the holding of these elections under new institutions and a new constitution in particular. And so I was specifically asked to talk about how the 2007 elections impact today and a perspective from the U.S. And so the biggest change, I think, is in the institutions, the new constitution of 2010 that leads to devolution. so that, in fact, capturing the presidency is not the entire prize as it was in the past, and rather now you have governors and bicameral legislations at the county or county assemblies, and so that power, the prize of the presidency in the zero-sum contest that often provokes is going to be less, I hope, under this new constitution and with these elections. Secondly, the judiciary has greater legitimacy and is seen as independent. And so the rule of law and the ability in the post-election contest in which there are likely to be challenges, there's greater confidence that this judiciary will actually be able to rule on those cases. Whereas in 2007, with all of the election challenges, there was no confidence in Kenya's judiciary, as my co-panelist has just mentioned. And then also the Independent Electoral and Boundary Commission. We all know that in 2007, the failure of the chairman to be able to make a determination of who actually won that election was part of leading to the 2008 violence. The IEBC is seen as more credible. We have to see how it operates under the pressure of these elections, because just like in 2007, they're very likely to be very close. The two front runners are really polling almost equally. And so the IEBC and its ability to determine through legitimate transmission of the votes and counting of the votes will be essential. And then fourthly, I would say that the difference between 2007 and why I feel more confident about the elections in 2013 is the consciousness both of the government around security as well as of civil society and the general population. Kenyans now do not want violence. They do not want a repeat of 2007, 2008. In some ways, the 2002 election, which went relatively well, in which there was a very clear winner, that being President Kibaki, and a loser, that being Uhuru Kenyatta, who accepted his loss, led to, I think, some complacency about how the 2007 election would take place. And instead, because it was so close and the institutions essentially failed, you had the type of violence and politicians, of course, mobilizing that violence. Well, in 2013, no one is going to allow politicians to mobilize the violence. Or at least there's a very strong civil society guarding against that type of mobilization, as well as the government being prepared for possible post-election violence and deploying their security officials accordingly. And so I feel that the chances for Kenya are much better, and mainly because of the public attention and the new institutions. Now, from a U.S. perspective, these elections have tremendous they have a tremendous stake for our interests. We have an interest, as President Obama in his video message said to the Kenyan population, we have a stake in free, fair, and peaceful elections in Kenya. Stability of the region. We saw in 2007 how the violence in Kenya had a direct impact on economic development in Uganda and in Rwanda and Burundi, basically the landlocked countries, and it would have the same effect in South Sudan. We can't afford for Kenya to be destabilized. Obviously, Kenya has joined the fight against Al-Shabaab in Somalia, which is a key interest of the United States in counterterrorism in the Horn of Africa, so it's a critical player. Kenya is the economic engine of East Africa. It's our major trading partner of the five countries of East Africa, and it's the hub of all many international organizations and American businesses who are operating throughout the region. And so the stakes are very, very high, not only to say that many of the social challenges that Kenya faced in 2007 remain unresolved. And so we can't afford to have another period of post-election violence. And I will end by saying that I don't agree with my friend here on the ICC and the role of the ICC and even the motivations of the politicians who are running, the candidates. I personally believe that the candidates are running because they want to be the president and the vice president of the country. I don't think it's the narrow interest of trying to protect themselves from the ICC, and I say that because they've run before when they weren't ICC indicted. These are professional politicians in Kenya, and I don't also agree that they're somehow new alliances that are permanent. One of the characteristics of Kenya's elections is how easily candidates change parties and change alliances. Let's take Mudavadi ran with Uhuru Kenyatta in 2002. Kalonzo Musyoka, as has been said, ran with Kibaki and against Raila. Ruto ran with Raila against Uhuru. It's been a tradition in Kenya to count communities. It's ethnic counting that partly forms the alliances of who can possibly win. And so I don't see it as a reaction to the ICC, and in fact, I do think that the ICC has become a problematic factor in these next elections and is being used politically, not only by candidates, but also by Western countries. And that, well, I will conclude my remarks with how troubled I am, frankly, by the statement of the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Johnny Carson, essentially meddling in Kenya's elections. Kenya decides. Kenyans have the right to determine who's going to be their president. And the United States and Western countries should not be essentially threatening Kenyans about that choice by pointing to an ICC case that's unproven. You know, we cannot be the judge, the jury, and the executor of the candidates. And so I'm very pleased that Kenyan institutions, again, very independently, i.e. the High Court, made a decision which essentially said innocent until proven guilty. And so the candidates can run. And so it seems to me very reckless and irresponsible, frankly, given that the election is very close and it's not our business anyway to decide for Kenyans for us to try to intervene in Kenya's election decision.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Fraser. And that makes for an interesting panel here when you have disagreements. That is exactly what creates an interesting discussion. Professor Kimenyi, I think you said enough at the beginning. I'm not going to give you 5 minutes to speak.
Okay, okay, very good. I would like to listen more of this debate, but I would like to probably say just a one word, and it looks like ICC is going to influence a lot of what happens. But we also need to not forget that beyond the presidency, we have new institutions that, as the ambassador said, about new county governments. To me, as we just focus on these top seats, we need to really remember that the big institutional change is where we are going to establish local governments, lower level governments, where we expect better service delivery. That was what was going to matter for a lot of the Kenyans. So as these guys fight and make a lot of noise, we need not to forget that Kenya has actually changed by these new institutional structures. But as I think I would like to mention to say that the ICC issue, the whole problem with ICC is that from the beginning has been seen now as a political process and a judicial process. And the moment a particular process moves from judicial to political, people don't think it's fair. And what has happened is that the fact that communities, which is unfortunate, feel victimized, they are able to come together because they see this is actually their victims. And I have to say, like the ambassador said, we have to trust our own institutions. We have a new constitution. We have vetting institutions that have already told these guys, okay, you pass this test, we are going to allow you to run. They have passed that test. If you are a foreign government, you should criticize the institutions, but not the outcome of the institutions. If you accept the new constitution and you want to support us to move ahead, you should not come and say, oh, you have this new constitution, it's rubbish, because it's producing bad results. I think it's a very bad way to run foreign policy. This should have come way before the nominations, way before to say that this is going to happen. So I was with Ambassador Carson here, Amade Ago, for another discussion, and I told him the same, that it would have been good if this was discussed way before, but don't do it when the elections are very close, because in the end, you could hurt the candidate, the other candidate, because what's happening is that the people are hardening their positions. And Kenyans are notorious by saying, by the past, they will say, oh, you are an agent of the West. We are not going to vote for this guy. So he is working for some agents. And that can backfire for a candidate who probably has nothing to do with it. So we have to be very careful how we approach foreign policy at a time when a country is trying to implement a new constitution. So I'll leave it at that.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor Kimeya. Just in case I say something, let me just make it clear that I work for the Voice of America, but whatever I say here today, I'm here as an individual. And so whatever I say on my own behalf, not on behalf of the Voice of America. Now, let's go to a few questions here. I think I'm going to start here with Professor Kanyinga. You know, as we speak today, there are several people in Kenya, thousands, in fact, who lost loved ones in 2007, 2008. We have orphaned children. We have men who lost their wives who lost their husbands, and people who lost their all their family. So 1,300 people or so. Nobody up to today has been taken to task over those, even as we talk about the case of the ICC. Now, recently, people have witnessed some eruption of violence in the Tana Delta area. Some say it is politically instigated, and they fear that such a kind of a scenario could actually kind of spread throughout the country during the election. The question is, what has been done since 2007 and 2008 violence to ensure that there will not be a repeat of those horrendous massacres? What has been done?
Thank you very, very much, Vincent. Of course, I think I began by pointing out that looking at Kenya, people tend to disagree a lot, and we have begun with a disagreement. That's exactly what I meant. You look at the same event and you have got different conclusions.
Yes.
Let me say that from 2008 period, a lot, of course, has been done, and one of the major things that has happened in Kenya is to have a new constitution that seeks to address the structural causes of the post-election violence that we had. It tries to establish devolved system of government that everyone is talking about here. That system of government is meant to address imbalances in development so that communities can take control of their own lives. The violence that we witness in Tana River, the violence that we have witnessed in northern Kenya, these are new forms of violence are not necessarily instigated by politicians, because they begin with the question of access to local resources, which all of a sudden spills over now to political issues as different communities seek to control the new devolved system of government. Then it becomes political. But it's a new form of violence in the sense that it does not have urging from the center, from the national politics. It is not linked to national politics as such, but it is rooted in the local dynamics, and it doesn't have the potential to spread widely across the country. Mm-hmm. Now, in some counties, what has been happening is that people have been negotiating. If there are several communities in multi-ethnic counties, people are negotiating and saying, you will go for this particular position as one community, this other community will go for this particular community. Constitutional democracy is taking root in some counties and making it possible for people to have a peaceful preparation for the elections.
Mm-hmm. Rather interesting. And just today we got to see this piece of news about the Chief Justice saying that he was actually threatened by men who claimed to have some allegiance to the Mungiki militia group or the gang. And so that also brings to question the fact that whether we have a new constitution or not, is everybody likely to respect it? Let me come to Ambassador Fraser. You've been there recently. You got a feel of the country. Would you say that people feel confident that whatever the outcome, there are mechanisms in place that will ensure there will not be that kind of violence?
Well, I think I agree with the professor. It depends on who you talk to and how they see it.
For the first time.
You hear some disease is what I would say, but that disease creates a vigilance, you know, a ownership about ensuring that the public does what's necessary, you know, to prevent the violence. I think that there's also a shift, or at least a necessity for the politicians to at least commit to nonviolence and to accepting the outcome of the elections. There's the codes of conduct, which they've all signed up to. And so, certainly violence is, you know, is possible, is likely, especially at the local level. But I do feel that the consciousness and the awareness of the communities themselves will help to arrest any type of national sweeping of violence which took place in 2008.
Mm-hmm. Professor Kimenyi, do you have anything to add on to that?
I think the preparedness to deal with any conflict is quite different than last time. But more importantly, I think the type of violence, you know, like the traditional areas of conflict, the conflict areas like in the Rift Valley, you are not going to get any conflict. You may get some conflict, but it will not be ethnic conflict. In fact, it will be within the same county or within the constituency, people arguing over the results of different candidates from the same area. And the way to testify to that is that during the primaries, we had some violence, like in Kisumu. And that was not ethnic violence. It was because of differences between two groups.
Thank you. I want to come back to Ambassador Fraser. You know, you did mention that this time around, the eyes of the international community are squarely on Kenya. And so it's a kind of a different dynamic. Last time, the international community kind of just reacted to a situation that nobody expected. And in fact, you would feel that the international community, including the U.S., probably didn't know how best to respond because nobody prepared themselves for what was unfolding at that time. Now, tell me, you were the U.S. envoy who was sent to Kenya at that time. First, just give me a sense of what are your best moments at that time? What are your worst moments? Give us this in the background of what we know happened at that time, what the U.S. position was while you were on the way there.
Well, it's hard to think back, but let me try. My best moment was watching Kenyans come together, particularly as reflected in the Save Our Beloved Country campaign, in which all of the headlines of all of the newspapers had the exact same words. And civil society essentially said, you won't do this to our country. You know, and I think that that was a turning point in the crisis. So that would have to be the best. Mm-hmm. And that's why I have confidence in the Kenyan public itself. The worst probably was the mirror imaging of the two sides about who won. Whether one talked to Raila or one talked to Kibaki or to their lieutenants, each one felt that the other was trying to deprive them of something and had cheated, and there were no institutions that we could turn to that were national institutions to actually determine that question. Mm-hmm. At the time, of course, President Kibaki was arguing for going to the courts according to the Constitution of Kenya at that time, which said that election disputes should be settled in the Kenyan courts. And Raila Odinga was saying those courts are already stacked by President Kibaki and his party, and therefore we don't trust our courts. And so that was really the worst, which is trying to devise a solution through essentially political negotiation and mediation, rather than we see in countries like Nigeria and others, which have also had hot contests in which there's disputed results, but they go to the courts. Mm-hmm. And so that's the worst.
Okay. Just if I may stay with you for a minute, sure. Now that actually you did take issue with Ambassador Kasson's position, you know, people don't remember that at that time, the U.S. seemed to have taken sides initially, mm-hmm. and that kind of changed position. How was that challenging to you?
I appreciate you asking a question because it's a misperception. But it's a misperception that I've come to realize was based on a mistake within the U.S. government. At the time, I actually blamed others, but I've come to, you know, look at that record. And what happened is in the wee hours of the morning, because remember the election was decided, I think, on, you know, very late. And the American State Department, we put out a press release which said the written press release was that I think it was something to the effect that we want to commend the people of Kenya for their vote, right? For their, because they basically voted very peacefully. The actual election was very peaceful. It was the counting and the transmission where the problem started. But the spokesperson, not the big spokesperson, I'm not talking about the main spokesperson, but the person late at night, not understanding the situation in Kenya, interpreted this statement, the written statement of commending the people as commending the election. And so essentially came out and said what was effect seen as congratulations, not to the people, but to the country on, you know, and which looked like congratulate President Kibaki. That was never said. It wasn't ever said congratulate President Kibaki. But because he put himself into office very late, he got himself sworn in very late, that statement of congratulations to the people was interpreted as congratulations to Kibaki. And so it was never the case that the U.S. position was that either side had won, because we maintained throughout that we didn't know. And frankly, that was for Kenyan institutions to tell us. And there was a failure of the one institution that was to arbitrate that, and that was the Electoral Commission. And so I appreciate your asking so that I can correct the record that the U.S. government took aside.
Thank you for your response. I hope it satisfies others too. Let's get to Professor Kinyinga, unless you have something to add on to that. But the other question that many are asking is, this election is happening. People are focusing on the presidential candidates of presidential election, but there are so many other levels of election. There are many other people being elected, governors, county governors, which is a new development under the new constitution. And of course, we have other civic leaders. The question is it enough? One day, is it sufficient to hold these elections smoothly, in your assessment?
In my assessment, I think it is very possible to hold the election, these five elections, the same day, the same booth, depending on the number of polling stations that we have in the country. Mm-hmm. The electoral, the IEBC has already come out in public and done a lot of demonstrations, did a lot of testing of the systems to find out whether it's going to be possible. And they have found out that each person will be taking close to 10 minutes to vote, mm-hmm. maximum number of minutes that are required. Now, it depends also on the logistics, how the IEBC is prepared in terms of laying the infrastructure for the voting in place. All said and done, I think one can say that logistically, IEBC is likely to pull it off. But it also depends on the infrastructure in different places and how you take ballot papers to different places. Each polling station will be having close to about 450 people, and that's manageable.
Yes. Professor Kimenyi, you have something to add on to that?
I think we have a very different system now. Although we keep, we still get bad news from Kenya. The country has changed a lot as you look at even in terms of economic growth and the economic reforms, and the electoral institutions are actually very different. I passed through Kenya from Rwanda one day on a Sunday afternoon, and it took me like 5 minutes to register to vote, and the stations were open. IBC was very efficient. So we have a lot of new changes, and I think it will be an efficient electoral process.
Mm-hmm. Professor.
Yeah, having said that, IBC seems to be prepared. I better mention that we have noticed a weakness with the IBC and the Registrar of Political Parties, enforcement of the existing laws. They are becoming lax. They are not enforcing the Elections Act, and they are not enforcing the Political Parties Act, and therefore some politicians may be taking it as business as usual. If they take it as business as usual and begin undermining the law during the electoral campaigns, then that's likely to affect even the organization that will be put in place.
Yes.
They need to start acting now and discipline political parties and discipline political actors in general.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Fraser, despite of your position of the ICC and what people think about what that court stands for and how Kenyans perceive things, in the event, for example, that Mr. Uhuru Kenyatta is elected president, and with this vice president, both of them being guests of the ICC, what do you see as a likely scenario in the way the international community will deal with this gentleman, and how will this impact the country, despite of what you may personally think about it?
Well, I can only give my personal view, but I personally think that the case is going forward, clearly in the ICC, and they will have to, go through a trial and let the evidence decide whether, in fact, Uhuru is guilty and Ruto's guilty or not. I think that the ICC is a very manipulated institution politically, particularly by the West. I think it has very selected and targeted individuals who are indicted. So I, for one, don't find the legitimacy of that institution I find it a not legitimate institution, is what I should say. Mm-hmm. But the case is the case. One of the problems of the ICC is how long it takes for a case to come. But hopefully this one will start early and end early so that the Kenyan people will know.
Yes, but as a person who has been an official of the U.S. government, just right. Hypothetically, if you were in the government today right. and this gentleman become leaders of the Kenyan government, how does the U.S. relate to them?
If I was an official of the U.S. government, myself, I would not be very much bothered by the ICC. I would be very pragmatic. I would recognize that the United States is not a signatory to the ICC. We'd never allow the ICC to try any of our officials, and I would work with the candidates. If they were then convicted by the ICC, it would be a different matter. But as long as they're simply accused, then let their case go forward, and the United States government, I believe, should work with them, just like we are currently. One is the deputy prime minister. We deal with him. Mm-hmm. Right. I think that we should continue to work with the Kenyan government, whatever the ICC's position is, until that point in which somebody is then held as tried and convicted. And then obviously they'll be taken away and the Kenyan people will decide how they want to deal. But I, for one, think that the ICC case, particularly against Uhuru Kenyatta, is a very weak one and based on hearsay. Mm-hmm. And I think the institution is very much a manipulated institution of the West.
I hear groans in the crowd.
We're gonna have
you ask your questions. Professor Kenyinge, you want to make a point?
Just to make a point and say that ICC is the best thing to have happened in Kenya. It may not be the best thing to have happened elsewhere, but in Kenya, Kenya is the only country where senior and influential people are never held to account for anything whatsoever. And therefore, the fact that people are being dragged to the courts of law to account for suspicions of having committed a crime in Kenya is a good thing on its own, because it lays a very important foundation for the senior people to be told, no matter how far you run, no matter where you go, you will be treated like an ordinary person. And therefore, bringing these people to answer for those particular crimes, whether weak or strong, is an important step forward for holding Kenyan politicians accountable. The cases may be weak, the cases may be strong, let them be discharged the next day. But Kenya will have made a point that ordinary leaders need to behave and respect the rule of law. We wish they had even carried over 20 of them. That would have made a difference, because it is going to teach politicians a major lesson that the rule of law is important and their systems to be obeyed.
We agree on that.
We don't disagree on that.
I agree on that.
At the same time, I doubt whether the U.S., whether if she was in position in government, whether actually she would be dealing with them.
Oh, I would.
I doubt.
Yeah. I'm sure
I doubt.
Some people think about Omar al-Bashir and wondering what is the U.S. Relationship with this guy.
Yes.
And when Bashir was indicted, we dealt with him. We talked to him. We worked with him. Yes, we do.
Okay.
Yes, we do.
let's say we do to this day.
Well, this ICC issue is actually quite tough for Kenya. And I have written quite a lot about ICC, even before those envelopes were opened. And I said this is a very bad idea. And the way the investigations were done, the way the random way from an envelope with 20 people, with NGO input and all that, I think the issue of how justice is carried out is very important. And to me, I would have liked that we get the strong institutions and deal with our own people. In the end, ICC is going to make us, is leading, dividing us more. We are worse in terms of, as a country, because of ICC. And I don't see it solving any problem. And by the way, I also, and I may disagree with my friend, Professor Kanyinga, I think one case is already flopped, by the way. They are trying to create the case, but it's already flopped.
Okay.
So they are trying to create new witnesses, and it's really giving ICC a headache.
I'm going to ask you just one question, and then we go to the audience. Last week, the first presidential debate, which was ever nationally televised, was held in Kenya. First, do you think that it makes a difference? There's another one on Monday, and candidate Uhuru Kenyatta has said he's not going to participate in it. Professor Kanyinga, do you think it does make a difference?
The presidential debate makes an important difference in the sense that it cools down temperatures across the country, and people start looking at these politicians as very sober individuals. Because in political rallies, the kind of statements that they make are not the statements they were making at the during the debate. And therefore, it has sobered the country, reduced the mood to a mood of accommodation and tolerance. I would say that to as much as possible, it makes a difference. But it may not necessarily affect the voting patterns in any significant way. We have seen, of course, some changes from the opinion polls. People like Peter Kenneth getting a lot of support after the presidential debate, which he did not have. So it might make some difference in terms of cooling temperatures and also making people accommodate each other. But in terms of voting patterns and affecting their designated voters, that could be one thing, but I doubt whether it will make a lot of changes.
Okay. Any quick remarks before we go to the audience?
I think it was significant because they are talking issues, and that's important. And hopefully, you know, it's unfortunate Uhuru will not go to the next debate. I think it was important for people to talk about issues. And the next one was in economic issues and so on. So I think it was a good step.
Yeah, I actually was there in Kenya during the last one, and I was traveling through the country, and everybody was watching their screens, you know, at every station of life. And so I think it's important for the candidates to put themselves through that scrutiny, to stand on the stage together and have to answer each other and the persons who were questioning them. So I actually think it was a very good thing, and I think it would be a huge mistake for Uhuru Kenyatta to not participate in the second one. I think that the Kenyan population was both proud to hold the debate, but also learned a lot about the candidates.
Yes. In fact, he said in their statement that he does not want to participate in a skewed, shambolic, and farcical debate. I don't know how that would sound to the Kenyans. Some are speculating that he doesn't want to discuss the issue of land. We don't know what else. Let's take this opportunity now to turn to the audience. Thank you for your patience. You've been listening very closely. I'm just going to ask you, you put up your hand, and let's take, I think, like two, three questions in a row. Identify yourself and make your questions very brief. The first person, let's start with the one Okay, let's start with you because you're looking at me right now.
First off, I'd like to thank the panelists. This is, you know, in some ways I don't want to interrupt their discussion for our questions. I thought it was an excellent discussion among themselves. But there is one issue that wasn't referenced, which is the role of the private sector, the for-profit private sector. Prior to 2007, The Economist had this famous article about, with this election, the Kenyan private sector was ready to take off. And in fact, the election not only was politically disappointing, but it really interrupted growth for a period of time. But since then, the private sector in Kenya has actually become quite robust. There's been tremendous growth. There's been the Safaricom IPO. Does the private sector have a role to play in keeping the peace in the next election? Or is the private sector basically moved beyond and said, look, politics is not an issue for us. We will do our business outside of politics.
Quickly, your name, please. Sir.
John Simon with Total Impact Advisors.
Thank you. Next question right here where the mic is.
John Harbison, Johns Hopkins Sais for Karuti. I want to give you a chance to talk about how you think land issues might affect this election. The Waukee Commission was very clear that land issues were at the core of violence last time. As you well know, there's a new policy and a new commission, which has done nothing so far. So how is this going to affect the election?
Okay, third one right back next to you there.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Morgan. I run Red Eagle Enterprises. One question I have concern is regarding Somalia. You know, with the piracy, with all the money flowing into Mombasa, the new TFG government, and the military operations by Kenya in Somalia, how will that come back and play a role in this? Because that's almost like it's an issue that no one's been willing to talk about. What impact will Somalia have on this election?
Thank you very much. Let's have responses to these questions. Wants to take on the first one on private sector role.
Let me begin by saying that actually from 2008 to date, the private sector woke up and has been playing a very active role in talking about peace and in talking about politics and engaging with all political actors. They have formed a very robust infrastructure for engagement on governance issues through KEPSA, and they have what they call Amani Kenya, a coalition of private sector groups that is at the forefront of debating various issues of governance and talking with the various candidates to ensure that the elections are peaceful and also to ensure that there is democratic governance and the rule of law in general. We can say that they have become more politicized in what they do and in a very active manner. Regarding land issues and what their role is, I would say that the land question is becoming a very important and issue in the whole debate as we see it today. There is no single campaign issue. There is no campaign rally where the land question is not being referred to. However, that land question seems to be meaning different things to different people. And it's, of course, having different types of traction depending on the areas visited. At the coast, for instance, you will not talk about local politics without talking about the question of land. And this is where both the alliances are really trying to throw barbs at each other. Who is more credible in terms of addressing land problems? But no one says what kind of land problems you want to address. But as we all know, in agrarian societies, the structure of land ownership is equivalent to the structure of political power. And if you want to see our countries governed, whether democratic or not, look at the structure of land ownership and you'll tell whether it is democratic or not.
Thank you. Professor Kimmich.
I think the private sector has the greatest stake in this election in terms of loss. The private sector is doing very well. As John mentioned, we have a sort of a digital revolution of some sort. And it's been doing well. The country was able to actually survive the financial crisis without a major impact. It was very, very, very limited, and it's going well. But there have been a lot of economic reforms. There is a clear direction, particularly within the Vision 2030 framework. So the private sector is involved. In fact, I was involved in establishing KEPSA when I was at KIPRA. We established a private sector group that would actually be involved in terms of advocating for private sector issues because we knew that the private sector was sitting back waiting for results. Whatever comes out there, they move on. But now the private sector is a real actor because it really has a real stake. So I think and they are very interested in peace, which is very important.
And the presidential debate was organized as well by the private sector. They contributed to it and they are part of it.
Thank you. Now the question of Somalia.
You defeat Jedi.
Well, let me just take up the first question and then move into the second or the third. The private sector, I agree with my colleagues, has played a key role in ending the post-election violence in 2008 and continues to do so today. Obviously, many of the candidates are businessmen, lawyers, or professors. And so they have that in common, and particularly the major candidates. They have a business very much in common, and I think hopefully that will also act as a break along with the civil society. I only can answer in an impressionistic way about Somalia and the role of piracy. And really, when I was in Kenya, I've been there now twice this year, there's a lot of discussion about campaign finance. And there's a lot of money flowing around Kenya. And, I think that more research and probably IDS would be a place to do that research on where is money coming from and how is it influencing the candidates would be very important. The other thing, I was on the coast, and there's a lot of discussion about that Somali money buying land and quite a lot of land, especially from poor people, because there's a lot of money flowing into Kenya right now from Somalia. But that's just impressionistic.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, Professor Kenya.
Yeah, on the question of Somalia, perhaps the issue that is being paid attention to is the question of Al-Shabaab and the conflict in northern Kenya and insecurity in northern Kenya in general, and also some parts of urban areas. And that has got consequences on xenophobia in particular against the Somali population, but not really linked to politics in a very clear, direct way. It could be having an impact on Somali politics in northeastern province, but not across the country.
Yeah, but the money coming from Somali, the piracy specifically, yeah. Not the terrorism, but the piracy, there is a lot of money coming into Kenya.
And affecting property prices for the last 2 years.
Yes.
Before we get the next round of questions, just wanted you to expand a little bit on the land question. And the land question has been really the issue, the permanent issue in Kenya. There have been all these reports, including the Work Hill report. But do you see that commitment to implement these recommendations and to really resolve the land issue in Kenya? Or can it actually be resolved?
I think no one will run away from the land question, because the National Commission on Land is a constitutional commission, and the Constitution Chapter 5 very clearly says how land issues are going to be looked at. So no one is likely to run away from the national land question. The only problem is that it has been left to the National Land Commission, and therefore it will require a lot of political support and political goodwill to make it work.
Okay.
Yeah, but let me just say, though, that point is very much a concern about the politicization of the land question, which some people are saying, why are politicians now bringing this into the election when clearly there's an institution that has the authority to address, that the land issue is going to be addressed by the land commission. And so that has also led to a great concern about whether land is being used to spark communities against each other in this election.
Yeah, and perhaps it's a question of whether is there sufficient education on the ground so that those who own land understand the circumstances under which they own that land and the circumstances under which their neighbors who come from a different community live where they live, so that when they're told to kick these people out, they don't sharpen their machetes and drive them out of town. I mean, is there any process that goes on to kind of help the people to come to that understanding where they can coexist?
Let me say that it depends on actually the local politics that we have. For instance, in Rift Valley now, you don't expect any violence on land because of the alliances that have formed. So in terms of reconciliation, in terms of healing, one may want to say that the country is yet to heal from the post-election violence properly. It's yet to heal properly. But again, because of the ICC, no single politician is likely to mobilize violence against others. The beauty of ICC, Ambassador.
I don't agree, but we'll agree to disagree, as they say in South Africa.
Let's get the next round of questions. Let's start from right the back, the very rear of the room. Okay. Tell us your name and your affiliation, if possible.
Hi, I'm Rose Clouston from PAI. My understanding is that the new constitution requires the president to receive a minimum threshold of the vote from each county. What impact are you seeing that have on the electoral campaign, and do you expect that to have on the election response?
Okay, one. The next, let's go to the wall there on the left side of the building.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Cheryl Baer with the U.S. Department of Commerce. I'm interested in the panelists' analysis of the role of the East African Community Secretariat on these elections, and then how you see the future of regional integration efforts in the context of the outcome of the elections.
Okay, those are three, I guess.
Not two.
Two?
Yeah.
Okay, right here.
Hi, my name is Drew Westberg with the Brookings Institution, and it seems like everybody agrees that there's likely to be a runoff in this election. And I'm wondering how the panelists think that will change the dynamics and whether tensions may escalate in that period.
Thank you very much. So let's start with Professor Kamir.
So this is very good. The provision on the Constitution about the minimum number of votes, receiving 25% in 24 counties. That also actually is not a very stringent requirement. It's just about half of the counties that the presidential candidate is supposed to receive at least just 25% of the votes. Even before, we had requirement that there was a constituency requirement of a certain proportion also. Now, I think what has happened in terms of the 25% requirement again, is that the candidates have obviously, first of all, they have control of particular areas. Right now, each candidate has a particular area where they know they are going to get 80%, 90% or above. And then they have also identified several areas where they are going to receive at least that minimum. And I think at least the leading candidates already have assured that they are going to receive those votes. So anyway, it's provides for a national, you need to get a national approach, but still it's not so difficult to do that. I think in terms of the East Africa community, I think it's important to remember that Kenya in the East African area is like the anchor, as the ambassador said. It's like an anchor country, it's the strongest economy. And whatever happens in Kenya will have actually a lot of impact in the region. So the East African community has, the president of the other East African countries have actually come together, and they are very interested in terms of how the elections turn out. In fact, they made a statement telling the West to throw it, to shut up, in other words, and let the Kenyans decide. That's because they really want the Kenyans to decide and make it, because the community, we have, the East African community has moved very fast. And, we are all now very well integrated. And so they are very concerned if something happens in Kenya, it will happen in the other countries. The runoff will happen. I don't see it any other way at this point, although the leading candidates are tied at this point. It's unlikely any one of them is going to get the 50 plus. It's going to change the dynamics. And this is where I think things could get interesting in a way, or ugly, in the sense that people who go to vote for the runoff will be different in a way from those who vote in the first race. You are going to get a very high turnout in the first round, but you are not likely to get the same intensity in the next round. It is the people with the strongest preferences that are likely going to show up. So you may end up actually getting numbers now will matter at that point a lot. Your crowd will matter, not the crowd, but where you come from, and where the preferences are very intense. That's one likely outcome. The other one is that we could get one of the third candidate switching, there will be brokering. Someone will try and be bought and be promised something. And the third candidate could actually switch and support one of the other candidates. And that would have new ethnic alignments, but that could be the kingmaker.
Okay. Any other?
Yeah, I just want to say on the East Africa community, I think that the integration project will go forward as long as Kenya doesn't descend into violence, no matter who wins. The two front runners, Prime Minister Raila Odinga and Deputy Prime Minister Uhuru Kenyatta, both are very robust about integration, efforts of the East Africa community. And Kenyans, after all, having such a dynamic economy and, the level of capital when especially human capital, really benefit more than even the other four countries of the East Africa community from integration. So I don't see any change of policy in terms of Kenya being forward-leaning, no matter who is elected.
And a match on that?
Yeah, on East African integration, I would say that all the candidates actually in Kenya seem to be in full support of the East African integration, particularly because of markets. And given that Kenya has got the largest economy in the region, it needs East African integration more than other countries do. Coming to runoff, there is something that peculiar that is happening on the question of runoff across Africa today. The results are usually razor thin in size. In Ghana, the difference one time was 20,000 votes or 19,000 votes, I think in 2008. The same in different other places. And runoff really tried to cause a lot of anxieties because of the money, because it's now two blocks that are usually contesting. And in most instances, party identities are dissolved so that what we have in competition are ethnic blocks and ethno-regional blocks. And we don't see that not happening in Kenya. If there is a runoff, it will be fought on basis of ethnicity more than anything else. And therefore, what will matter most is who is the kingmaker, where are the swing votes coming from. And as my colleague has said, perhaps the most popular candidate may provide the support to one of the blocks, and that will lead to one block winning. Will there be legitimacy? Will the results be seen as legitimate or not? And I think Kenyans are ready not to accept violence, and they are ready not to accept anyone mobilizing against the results, as long as the results are credible, the results are free, and the results are fair. And then tied to that is, of course, the electoral system, the changes in the electoral system that and the threshold for the presidential candidate. That was meant actually to ensure that a winning presidential candidate has got support from as many communities in the country as possible, because there is no single community that has got more than, let's say, 9 counties to itself. Whether you talk about the Kikuyu, the Kalenjin, or the Kamba, none of them has got counties, has got more than 10 counties, and therefore, if you are required to have 24 counties, it means you must look for alliances from a broad group of counties, and therefore ethnic communities, so that at least you are a president who is respected and who has got the legitimate support from quite a number of people in the country.
On the issue of a runoff, actually, Kenyans are going to have a first on many things. This is going to be possibly the first time Kenyans will do a runoff, going to a runoff. Do you get the sense that the voters themselves are being prepared or are being prepared right now for that possibility? Or is it something that is going to come to them as a surprise? I think
the way when I listen to the candidates and the communities, they are trying to convince their people that they can actually win the first round. So make sure you go and vote. We can win this thing first round. But that's unlikely. Statistically, it doesn't look like it's going to happen. Although I must say I'm surprised by the performance of the other candidates. It's terrible. I mean, you're talking about with 1%, 2%. So I expected some of them to do much better, but they are doing, it's terrible.
Okay.
There is very limited civic education and vote education on the question of runoff. Even IEBC itself is not raising it as an issue that people should be aware about. And that's a major, major limitation so far.
Mm-hmm. Obvious things being left to chance. Huh? Yeah. Let's have the next round of questions. First, a gentleman in the white shirt right there. Paul.
Thank you. My name is Paul Ndiho. I'm an independent reporter, and I cover Africa very closely, and Kenya is one of the countries that I'm interested in. I wanted to follow up with what you said, Ambassador. You said you attributed some of the remarks made by Ambassador Carson as reckless and irresponsible, but I'm just curious to know, when you are serving the same role, some of your critics say that it was because of your policies, because of some of the statements that you made that really brought this whole chaos. I'm just curious to know whether you're willing to take personal responsibility, because if you had not called for the election, Other countries, other Western countries would not have followed suit. A lot of your critics say that it's because United States was one of the first countries to call on Kibaki to congratulate him that the rest of the Western media followed and everybody was congratulating Kibaki and therefore the chaos. So I'm just wondering if you in that role would take personal responsibility for, you just admitted not too long ago that that statement wasn't a correct statement. So would you take personal responsibility and say maybe it was a mistake, but you didn't correct the record?
No. Thank you. But I'll expound.
Yeah. The gentleman right here and then the lady.
David Throop from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. If Raila wins or if Uhuru wins, what do you see as the likely consequences in terms of the implementation of devolution and in terms of the performance of the Kenyan economy? Will there be major differences in terms of their strategies and their likely successes? And also, in terms of relations with the United States, do you see there being fundamental differences between a Raila presidency and a Uhuru presidency?
There you go. And let's have the final one from the lady.
Lulit Mesfen, with Gumboot 7, Movement for Democracy in Ethiopia. This question is for Ms. Carson. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Ms. Frazier. I'm sorry.
No problem. No problem.
I'm shocked to hear you say Ambassador Carson is reckless and he's meddling in Kenyan affairs and he is irresponsible when you did the exact same thing in Ethiopia in 2005 election. In 2005, you were accusing the opposition of trying to overthrow the regime of your friend, Malala Zenawi, after he stopped the election on May 15th. Okay? It was a free and fair election in Ethiopian history for the first time. He declared a state of emergency. He massacred 193 people, including a 14-year-old boy, a 75-year-old man. He imprisoned the entire opposition. And he arrested masses and masses of Ethiopians and actually put them in concentration camps. And you were there defending him. And I don't know how you can, you know, say Mr. Carson's meddling when you did the exact same thing. Sure. Is there a change of mind now after 7 years?
All right, thank you. Now let's take this round of questions. Let's start with Ambassador Fraser.
Please. I love these speeches. On the first question about do I take responsibility for chaos, absolutely not. I did not organize a single person in Kenya to kill another person. Let me finish. I listen to you. Let me finish. The U.S. government, I said that the State Department, a person within the State Department, not myself, misinterpreted the congratulation of the Kenyan people, which is a statement that I had a part in writing, for congratulations of Kenya. Other Western countries did not follow suit, as a matter of fact. So the connection that you're suggesting is not true. It's simply not true. And I explained that at the very beginning. I did take responsibility. I said that a mistake happened within State Department, which I denied initially because I didn't believe that was the case. But on investigation, I found out indeed that the statement that was written congratulating the people when spoken was interpreted as congratulating the country. And therefore, not a congratulation of Kibaki, by the way. That was not what was said, but was interpreted then by the press as us supporting his election and his inauguration. And so, no, I don't take responsibility for chaos, but I'm very clear about the mistake that was made by State Department that was not, as you said, followed by other Western countries and did not, by the way, lead to the violence which had already started at that point. I think that the U.S. government can be very, very proud of the role that we played in getting to Kenya first or early, not first, because the African leaders were actually there before, and playing a role to say to President Kibaki, you can't just take this, and to say to candidate at that time, Raila, you can't just grab this. you're going to have to either rely on your institutions or find a negotiated solution. So, yes, I'm very proud of that. Then on the question of Ethiopia, in 2005, I was ambassador to South Africa during Ethiopia's elections. So that you should be very clear of. 2009, I was leaving. I was Secretary of State for 21 days of 2009. January 2009, I left when President Obama came into office. Okay. You know, so no, I did not have anything to do with Prime Minister Meles Zenawi's election.
But you were defending him.
I was not defending anything. I was not defending anything. I work with the Ethiopian government, just like I work with most African governments, whether we like or dislike. I worked with the Ethiopian government. But I was the U.S. ambassador to South Africa. I had no say. I was talking about South Africa. I had no say over Ethiopia's elections.
Well, thank you. Now let's take on the other questions. The other question was on the consequence of the presidents of any of the two.
Okay, devolution is a very strong movement now in Kenya, and no president is going to reverse the implementation of the constitution. I don't see any one of them coming to change anything in the provisions of the constitution. So that's going to proceed, and the people actually are very keen to see the establishment of the county government. So neither Raila or Uhuru is not going to affect this. In terms of economic growth, I see that all we need is peace. The institutions that we have are very good. I have looked at the manifestos of all these candidates, and 80% of them are lies. They are not achievable. So just throw away. They are not achievable. They are not going to be done. So we forget about the manifestos. They are just political statements. In fact, we should rely on more on what is already on the ground by the current Kenya government on the Vision 2030, which is being implemented. But these are the things that they are talking about. Where would the money come from to do all the things that they are proposing? But the implementation of the constitution will continue, and Kenya is an economic, in terms of takeoff, will actually make major progress if and only if we have peaceful elections, nothing else.
Yeah, and indeed, none of the candidates has come up with any strategy on how to change things in Kenya, and that makes them all the same. They're kind of the same in every way. Any remarks you want to make regarding that question?
To begin with, I think the Uhuru presidency and the Raila presidency will approach devolution from a very different point of view. To begin with, I think Raila, if you look at Raila's track history with regard to issues of decentralization, he came from ODM and even LDP from the old days. They were demanding Manjimbo. They left that one on the side. And they have been, the people were very central in trying to articulate a full devolution during the Naivasha negotiations. Uhuru Ruto leadership, I think, even if Ruto is there and comes from Rift Valley, will be tempered with the whole question of how do you address the question of devolution in a way that is not Manjimbo. One may want to say that although there is pressure from below, although there is a lot of pressure from below, the form it will take will depend on the leadership that will take over finally. In terms of performance, economic performance, one needs to note that our economic growth declines during every election year. We have only 3 years and a half of economic growth from 1992, and then growth declines and rises up again after the elections, 6 months after the elections. That has been the trend. Sometimes to negative 1%, agriculture growth declines to about negative 6% every election year without exception, and then rises up again. So I don't think this is going to be an exception, although we have seen some good signs.
It's not true. 2002, the change in 2002 was followed by a major change in growth.
But when did the growth pick up? The growth picked up from 2003, please.
Yeah, but it never dropped.
It never dropped, but yeah. It was about 1%, 2%.
In any case, it was very low before.
It was very low even before.
No, all right.
It has never gone, during an election year, it has never been above 2%.
Yeah. Maybe we need to get those reports. Those are economic facts.
Yeah.
And I have them here with me.
Yes.
Yes.
let me just, on the question about the role of the presidency and U.S. policy, yeah. Whether it's Raila or Uhuru, I think there won't be much difference, frankly. Both Raila and Uhuru on foreign policy would align themselves with U.S. foreign policy, both in the region and internationally for the most part. There's no major difference between them. The only issue will come up if the ICC continues to hang over Uhuru's head. And so that's really an issue about how quickly will the trial happen. But even if the Kenyan people vote for Uhuru to be president, I'm positive that the U.S. administration will be dealing with him, particularly under Secretary Kerry, who also, when he was senator, was dealing with the Sudanese for President Obama in a very pragmatic way,
okay.
Given our interests.
Okay, we're kind of about done with the time, but one question, just one question, I think, and then we have quick responses and we end it. Let's go with the lady right there, right here. Okay. In my business, we keep time.
Hi, thank you. My name is Ateno Duor, and I wanted to ask, in looking at the post-election period, assuming that there's a peaceful transfer of power, what do you think will be Kibaki's legacy on governance in Kenya in general? Do you think that will be significant or not?
All right, thank you very much. Let's have a quick round of responses to that. Let's start with Professor Kimeny.
It will be mixed, but overall positive. And I would say on the positive side is on the economic front. But even though there have been a lot of setbacks, if you think about the referendum, was conducted under his regime. The implementation of the constitution has started under his leadership. So I think it will be positive, although there are also some areas which are lagging behind. But for me, I think one of the things that will remain for President Kibaki is that he actually somehow have managed to change the infrastructure of the country that is quite different now. And that is a major driver for the economy. So I have a very positive view for the president. In fact, I think if we had not changed this constitution and he ran again, he could have won.
Thank you. Any quick
comments? Yeah, sure. I think it's mixed as well. And I would put in the positive column his role in the economy. I would put education, particularly primary education, free education. I guess I would add foreign policy. Kenya's been a really stable partner to its neighbors and constructive to the region. The negative side is the result of a government of national unity. In some ways, it's good that they negotiated, but in many ways, it's a failure on the part of that entire leadership, I believe. To have gotten to there. So the professor said at the beginning, which is what is really hurtful, is that there's so many internally displaced people still to this day, and I would put that in the negative column.
Mm-hmm.
Kibaki's legacy, of course, in terms of economic growth is on record, and in terms of infrastructure, improved living standards, if one can set that. Poverty levels have declined in the last 10 years. From 56% to close to 40-something percent. But his major failure, is the failure to manage politics and political development in that country. Mm-hmm. Ethnicization, Kenyans are now more deeply divided than ever before, including more than they were during Moi's period. And this is actually blamed on Kibaki. He's leaving Kenya a very divided society, a very deeply divided society along ethnic lines.
Okay, and on that note, I want to thank our distinguished panelists, Ambassador Fraser, Professor Kenyinga, and Professor Kimeny. It was very an interesting discussion and debate and agreements and disagreements. And I want to thank all those of you in the audience for your rapt attention, and you did not heckle or throw stones or anything at us, and for your great questions. Thank you very much. And the panel is over now. Thank you.